What am I going to talk about tonight? Divine Hermaphrodite. Divine Hermaphrodite. How many of you saw the film about sex changes in the Caribbean recently? How many? Let me see some hands. Oh, there are some intelligent people in the audience. Yes. What did you think about the fact of sex change? For years I've been saying when I was a little girl, and people have been thinking I was joking. Of course I was not. It is actually a truth that the type of life is a monocell, like an ovum, and that a sperm is a considerably further advanced, you may now bow, gentlemen, further advanced form than the ovum in its primal state. We can take the ovum as the type of woman. We can take the sperm, wriggling and pushing around, as the type of man. That being so, as each life begins with the type of ovum, we have to say the analogy holds, and we all begin as women. On earth, that is. And that means that we are stressed in certain ways. Towards the earth, towards bulk, towards receptivity. The sperm is biased towards drive, penetration, initiation. But the sperm is only a developed ovum. It started its life like an egg, like a female, and it acquired the tail by energy input devoted to externalization. We could therefore say that the man is naturally extrovert and the woman is naturally introvert. That's as far as life on earth is concerned. But supposing we go back to the source of life, before the earth exists, before it is condensed as a solid globe, it is part of the solar mass of incandescent energy. And before it was incandescent, the same energy was in the dark. It was not radiant. You all did your physics at school, and you learn that matter has phases, solid, liquid, gaseous, and the fourth one, incandescence. If you take a solid thing and heat it, you can liquefy it. If you take the liquid and heat it, you can turn it into a gas. If you take the molecules of gas and stimulate those, usually we do this electrically, the gas molecules will become so agitated they will begin to radiate light. They will become incandescent, which you see in a fluorescent tube with which you're all familiar. So we can say solids, liquids, gases, incandescence. And then we must reverse this order because factually the earth condensed from an earlier state. We can take it back. One time the earth was more fluid than it now is. The atoms constituting it were sliding over each other. Before then, they were dancing about, bouncing from each other like a gas. And earlier still, they were incandescent, they were agitated. But earlier still, they were in what would be to us darkness, like the trapped dark of a black hole. So, in terms of involution, we should start with pure darkness, pure nescience, pure not-knowingness, and then the energy that is there in the dark must, by self-agitation, because there isn't anything other than it, there's nothing other than it to agitate it, so the primary agitation must be a self-agitation. It must make itself incandescent. It then becomes like a nebula, which we see in the night sky. And then this nebula begins to turn, a spiral nebula. It goes from the form of the crab into a form, say, in Andromeda. And then it begins to condense itself to make suns, and then to condense further to make planets. So the order of involution is from invisible power to visible power to rotating power, condensing through the stages atmosphere, liquid, solid, down to our Earth. So if we like to imagine the power that constituted the world, before there was a solid Earth, before there was a fluid Earth, before there was a gaseous Earth, before there was an incandescent nebulous mass, there was an eternal darkness. And this is the view of the rabbis in the book of Genesis, when it says, "And darkness was upon the face of the deep." Don't think that the statements made in the Bible are rubbishy, primitive science. They are not. They are mythological statements, and the myth comes out of very, very deep experience. The difference between a piece of logologic, and mythologic is this. The logologic is a vibration of the infinite field structuring itself, structuralizing itself, so that, in fact, by its own vibration, it constitutes itself as an eidetic field. That is, a field of ideas. But the ideas are not what we call today mere ideas. They are vibrant forms of invisible power. They are structuring the universe. There is an infinite eidetic structured field before there is any visible evidence of it. What do we see there? In that primordial darkness, we see that there must be that already hidden in potentiality, which later on comes to exist, comes to precipitate itself as the world we now know. So that we have to say, in that hidden darkness was the potential of becoming an incandescent nebula, like the Crab Nebula. The potential of beginning to spin, like the Andromeda Nebula. The potential of becoming condensed, like the millions of stars, each one of which is like our own sun. And the precipitation around each such center of further condensations, which we call planets. All these must have been hidden in that primordial darkness, at least as potentialities. Really, heavy thought will tell you they're not mere potentialities at all. They are actualities at a very, very high frequency. That frequency we call Aleph, using a Hebrew letter, because we've used up all the Greek letters for something else. When we use a Hebrew letter in that way, we're taking an idea that might have a scientific formulation like Alpha, but we are saying now we are lifting it back to its original position as a metaphysical proposition. And the Hebrew letter Aleph, which my friend Michael Solomon always thinks I'm joking when I say things like this, the Hebrew letter Aleph, which he said in a lexicon to mean an ox, really means what an ox means. An ox is something that keeps the thing turning. If you draw the word ox, you will draw a circle, and instead of putting the cross outside the circle, put it inside the circle, and you have then done an elementary drawing of a wheel, haven't you? 1O, 1X. And that is the original form of that word. It is simply a drawing of a wheel, and it means to turn and to bear a load. So the word ox, the word Aleph, means supreme infinite bearer of all subsequent reality that might appear. Let's look at that, and we can see that because all things come from it, that what we mean by potentiality must mean at that level actuality. Because it cannot pass from a condition of non-action to a condition of action. So that it must actually be a very, very peculiar type of action. We say potentiality when we mean a power held in. We talk about PD, a potential difference. between the two ends of an electric wire with electrons flowing down it. That potential difference is an actuality. When we say potential, we mean power held in. But it is only held in from us, from our position as finite observers. At its own level, it is not held in at all. It is activating itself. And this is why the definition of God, by good theologians, is the actus purus, pure actuality. God is not potentiality. God is actuality. But actuality at the top level is so fine that very gross, dimmed beings like us cannot actually see it. We have been demoted. We ourselves have been sent down from a condition of primordial darkness, of which the symbol is a Hebrew letter Ayin, which means both an I and a pure negation, because it means an observer without anything to observe. Pure consciousness with no object. Now we have been sent down from that condition. By down, we use the word down deliberately because it says de-own. We have been divided from the infinite in order to own the finite. To be down is to be an owner of a limited area of activity. That is down. Up, to the contrary, means power positing itself. Power positing. That's above pay. Power positing itself is up. We have been demoted. We have been sent down from primordial darkness, and darkness mysteriously means light, hidden from lower levels of awareness. We have been made incandescent as a first stage from the darkness, shine. We look, we see. What do we see? We see phenomena. The word phenomena comes from a base, far, which simply means to shine, to appear. From that primordial darkness, the first step down was light. Think about that, it's very interesting. The first step down is a step into light. Why is it a step down? Because in the light we see things. And in the moment of seeing, we are in serious danger of falling further into identification. First there is light, like the Crab Nebula. And then if we are not careful, the light will catch us like a moth caught by a candle flame, and we will start rotating round the centre of the light to see what it is. And this is the passing from the condition of the Crab Nebula to the condition of the spiralling Andromeda. We start to rotate round any point of interest, and to do that we have gone down from primordial darkness, which is hidden omniscience, only hidden from us, not from itself. To itself it is a volitional actuality. To us it is a hypothetical possibility. Then we are sent down into the light. In the light we see. In the seeing we become interested. In the becoming interested we are verschwindelt. We are turned round. We are spun. We are made to spin on an axis, and we pass from primordial nescience in the infinite darkness of pure volition into the light of eidetic structures that we call ideas, abstract ideas. And we are then sent down further. As we spin, what do? We form suns. Each one of these suns is then a monadic center of an individuated being, utterly self-determined, because it is actually that darkness self-precipitated into a ball of fire, like our sun. And then we get sent down even further. We get sent down by condensation, by cooling, into the condition of the earth. And that earth is our bodies. When we go down into body identification, we have hit bottom. When you tap yourself on the patella, you're touching minerality. If it hurts when you do it, you can hurt yourself, you can do it very hard, yes, that hurts a bit. If it hurts, that's one step above minerality, that's biological. That is your sensation possibility, which in the mineral is held in very tightly in the plant is beginning to loosen, in the animal is beginning to roll about, in the man is beginning to keep an account of its own activities. So we are all sent down in that way. And then, in a primordial sense, primordial, first order sense of the biological, we find precipitated the monocell, the lowest form of life, roughly spherical, but tremulous, undulating, able to distort itself, to put out a pseudopodium, a false foot, like an amoeba. An amoeba is a monocell, a very simple life, which has, like all life has, a capacity for self-adjustment to its environment, a capacity for predatory activity. There was a marvelous nature film shown in which an amoeba flowed round two slightly higher order animals, paramecium, and it engulfed two of them at once. Did any of you see that marvelous film? Where an amoeba swallowed two paramecium simultaneously. What did the paramecium do? No, they didn't attack it. They attacked each other. They blamed each other for the trouble they'd got into. Now, isn't that terribly human? And the paramecium, fighting together, beating each other's brains out, attacking each other very fiercely, while they were fighting, were being slowly digested. And they finished up as a sort of globule together in the middle, not able to fight. And before they died, they were just sulkingly disgusted with each other, letting each other down. And the amoeba had got the benefit of their quarrel. If they had got together, their heads together, said, let's attack this so-and-so. Where's the nucleus? Gather together, boys, club together, and both together attack the nucleus and eat it. The amoeba would have been defeated. But they did not, like human beings, because they are human beings in their early stages. Sometimes we wonder whether we're in the early stages. Naturally, they blame all other human beings for their own mistakes. Even in the deepest intimacy of the marriage bed, there is a tendency to blame the other person if cold air comes in at the bottom of the bed. Have you done that, Gerhard? You know why you've not done it. You've already got all the clothes spiraled around you. And Marguerite's gone in the next room, haven't you, dear? Well, this is what tends to happen. We have been sent down. But in our primary form, we do not have the smart, wiggly-tailed sperm. That's a later evolution. Do you remember how we described how this activation occurred in the monocells? Can anybody tell me what we said about how this primary differentiation occurred? Or shall I do a little drawing? Shall I do a little drawing? This horrible machinery. That is the surface of the sea. Should have been in blue, but it isn't, because it's the Red Sea. That is the ground of the sea. This is the land side here. And there is the sun shining, one shiny sun. And here are some monocells getting lots and lots of sunshine. And the whole of this sea is full of these monocells. And in that totality, we call it primordial soup, the very primal substance which required just a stroke of lightning to cause it to fall into cellular form. So there are cells all over. But down here at the bottom are some cells which do not get much solar stimulation. They're in the deep dark bottom of the ocean. But over here, there is a moon. And the moon has a peculiar power to cause marine animals, just before the full moon, to come up to the top. It actually lifts water. That's how you get tides, isn't it? So that down in the depths here, the monocells that have no tails, once a month, feel a pull on them to come up. Would you believe that's the origin of menstruation? They have a tendency to come up when the moon is full, and to go down when the moon goes away again. But where the sun is shining, the energy input into those cells makes them very active. Now, a spherical being, if it becomes very charged with energy, starts jittering, and then it feels it must do something about the jitters, and it starts moving about. And as soon as it moves, it elongates itself a little bit. That's how paramecium arose from the simple monocell, by simply elongating itself. And then, by further energy input, it made an economic device, a tail, which by lashing about, it could flagellate itself, the origin of that weird human aberration, flagellation. It could whip itself about very vigorously. And that was the very type of masculinity. And what do we see? In the moon cell, we see a passivity and a waiting for the tidal effects to draw us up into activity at the surface. And in the sperm, we see the dynamic, irritant tendency to drive somewhere. Two basic characteristics: the passive receptive of the moon, the active initiating of the sun. That is all creating this primordial difference. Keep that in your mind and realize that every man and woman on earth today has actually proved by its present existence a process of evolution from a primordial state before there was the cut into what we call male-female. A primordial, non-differentiated field of energy, which, as it began to form itself into globules without tails, which we now call the feminine mode, became moon-determined. But those that were sun-attacked, sun-energized, they became what we today call males. And their residual traces inside human bodies are the ova and the sperms in the woman and the man. Now, there is absolutely no difference whatever in the primordial life substance from which this polarity occurred. And the polarization occurred because we were sent down. You see this in the Genesis story, where Adam is made in the image of God, male and female. But mysteriously, the woman was inside him because there was nobody to help him. And God said, well, try the animals, will they help? And he examined them all and said, no, they won't do. Finally, God put him to sleep. This is that histolysis process we were talking about again. And in the process of the sleeping of the primordial man, that is primordial protoplasmic man, before differentiation as we now know him, there was abstracted from him that aspect which we now call, in its supersessed form, femaleness. It was actual inside Adam. When it was taken out of Adam, it was called woman, because it was taken out of man. It was called Eve because that word means that which develops the life forms. But before it was taken out, it was called Lilith. Now Lilith is the very image of playing about inside oneself in an onanistic way. deriving whatever pleasures there are simply from an introvert process. No extroversion, a wholly introverted process in which is set up inside the image of a relationship within. So that man, that Adham, Dharma, that hidden male-female, was not yet a separated body. He was not sexed. He was not sectioned yet. Sex only means sectioned. The primordial type of life is not sectioned into male-female. It is simply a being wrapped up in its own process. I imagine that process. In it, there is an awareness that one is a body. That's a feminine thing. There is an awareness of sensations, of pleasure, preference for pleasure, dislike of pain. Both of those are feminine. There is an awareness that one has a form, and that is masculine. That form will later be called the idea. And there is an awareness that one can take the initiative, one can change one's form, one can extend, push out a pseudopodium, make an arm like an amoeba does. These four faculties, these four powers, are inside this primordial being that's called in Genesis Adam. Ad, Da, Am, Ma. Hebrews read this way and we read it that way. So when you see Adam, translate Da, Ma. Da, Ma is hidden inside. Later on, when St. Paul was on the road to Damascus, he had a kind of nightmare, and he said, my God, the whole thing is as clear as mud. We are Dama. Damascus. The word means nightmare, but it also means father and mother horse. Horse means salvation, obviously. The moment man had caught a horse and trained it, he had elevated himself above the animal. That's the figure of the centaur in mythology, the man who has learned to control his own animality is a centaur. He is a cantor who is permitted to sink down his nose in synagogue and frighten people at weddings by his powerful nasal tone. Da Ma is simultaneous throughout the universe and before the universe exists in the hidden darkness of the infinite is Da and Ma, hidden from us but not from itself. The hidden Da Ma is the capacity, Da, for self-division, self-activation, self-ideation, self-initiation. The Ma is the power of self-substantialization, of feeling oneself as a substantial being. Now, if you think about that kind of being, in the dark, infinitely self-aware of a terrific power of self-division, it can make any shape whatever. And it does so simultaneously. And it can substantialize itself, stand on itself, use itself as its own unders by simply precipitating onto centers. And when it precipitates on centers, it makes substantia. It makes an understanding for itself. So how does that being feel? That is the being that we call Godhead in his hiddenness. Hiddenness not from him. Hiddenness from us, unless we do the same thing that he does. Now, he doesn't do anything except examine himself, examine his own precipitations of form, feel his own self-substantializations. He never looks outside himself, because there is no outside, because he is infinitely extended. He has no need of anything, because there isn't anything except him. He is entirely self-sufficient. Now, how would you feel if you were infinitely self-sufficient? You could have a drive-in cinema show of your own by driving into yourself, show yourself your own film with Catherine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, and tyrannical power, and all kinds of funny things. You see them at will and immediately, no waiting. I had a friend, a barber named Murray, and his notice outside the shop said, "Murray, no waiting. You can go in there and have your ears cut off any time of the day without waiting." But he's a very fast worker. Needless to say, he died about 40 years of age through overwork. But he was a nice boy before he went, ever ready to please. Now imagine the infinite Godhead hidden in the dark is our source. And we have been demoted by the process, first of all, of saying, he said that, you know, "Let there be light." And the moment light appeared, what happened? All the hidden actualities became phenomena. They became visible actualities. And they all looked around like this and said, "Good God, phenomena." They were all phenomenologists in those days. Can you believe that? Phenomenologists. And they all started screaming. The name of one of them was Søren Kierkegaard. And he started screaming, "Subjectivity is truth." And the darkness said, "Wait a bit, wait a bit. Wait till the 1840s before you say that. Otherwise you won't get a proper hearing." So he calmed down. But the strain of calming down killed him at an early age too. Now, nothing comes out of a bucket that we don't put into it in the first place. Nothing has come out of that infinite darkness except that which is in that infinite darkness. And we are still in the infinite darkness, but the infinite darkness has played a trick on us deliberately for a very definite reason. And that reason is that prior to this trick, the infinite darkness was an infinite, omniscient, omnipotent, self-internalized being, knowing itself absolutely and enjoying itself absolutely. And it was enjoying itself so much, it said, "Oh, I wish there were some more creatures to enjoy this joy." Now, how could it make creatures to enjoy the joy without pluralizing? It couldn't. It had to say, either I have to remain on my own, or I must go down to the ground and die, and then I'll bring forth fruit, lots of me. So he voted, not like the Knesset, who say funny things like, "We have, after a long debate with our three-party system, come to the decision that we should not make decisions about whether to give back the land of the Arabs or not. Leave it in suspense." Now, God didn't do that. He said, "I'll risk it." It's dangerous, because he's got nothing to make this plurality of except himself. It's not dangerous to him, you understand. He's okay. It's dangerous to the bits that he makes, because he can only make these bits out of him. And these bits, each one of them called a monad, a one-off, a lord of its own being, that's the Adrut, Adonai, Achad. He's a lord of himself, each one of those, and it is God that has pluralized himself and made lots and lots and lots of gods. But it's very risky, because when you make gods out of God, each little god is like God in every respect except one. That is, it isn't in the dark, it's in the light. And in the process of precipitation, it has become separated off from the others. It looks around and it sees phenomena from its own center. And it says from its own center, "Those beings are moving about like monads, like I do. I wonder if they're gods or not." And then it finds some of them are very sleepy. And they make a very good diet, the sleepy ones. Because one of these gods, by gobbling up other gods that are a bit dopey, can appropriate their energy to himself. It's all right, it's quite ethical. It's only God eating God. Can't be a law against that, can there? So those who are a bit more awake than the others start eating the dopey ones and defining them as food. Food actually means force, power, divided off from the infinite for assimilation by a finite. Now, in the process of this encapsulation that makes out of infinity, the monad, we have a process which occurs, and it looks like that. In the center here is the original precipitate, the true essential monad, the one of each. We could repeat this diagram an infinite number of times, and that would constitute a diagram of the universe of monads. And each one of us is one of those. The innermost part there is essential will. The essential will of the being is the innermost part. But that innermost has exactly the same capacity that the infinite God has. The only difference being that he is now in appearance, whereas the invisible God is not in appearance. This one is phenomenal. It has shown itself. It has come out from the infinite darkness into self-presentation in the process of segregation and time. And then, as it's in the presence of an infinity of other monadic beings of the same order, we could start, if we wish, drawing others. I won't bother to change the colour, like that. And it is surrounded by those, and at this point here, the periphery, there is an external stimulus. So we have an immediate opposition, a centre of volitional initiative. That's our very essence. That's our very real beingness. And because we intend to spread out, because we were infinite, were we not, in the dark, so we have a deep ambition to get back to our infinity, so we tend to spread out. But so do all the others. And the result is that there is a collision at a certain distance, which we call the periphery of being. I did that brown to symbolize the earth body. Between your center of initiative and your earth body perimeter there, I hadn't got any blue, so I did it in green, but now I know you'll forgive me, because green is about the middle color in the color spectrum anyway. There is your intellectual life. At the center of your being is your volitional life, pure volition, no thought, immediate volition. You do immediately, without thought, something. And the first thing you do, of course, is expand. But you're doing that inside an infinite field of other monadic expanders, and all your energy is going out, crash, against the energies of other beings. And it is this crashing on your periphery of other energies that you call your skin surface. Your skin surface is only that distance from your initiating center, which has been imposed on you by other centers pushing out. So we have no limiting factors upon us other than the willed intention to limit us of other beings, which is fair play, considering our intention with them. Now, if we now say that the center of initiative, by definition, is a primordial point, because of the tail of the sperm, the drive, the wiggler, we have to say the center of that being there, in our analogy, is the male part of the being. It is the part that first forms, that's eidetic, that is the idea, and it is the part that first initiates. What it first initiates is form, idea. So the will's first sphere around it is a sphere of ideation, a sphere of thought. And it pushes that thought out as far as it can, and it collides with another being, and then in the collision spins. Did you see that lovely microphotograph recently of an obum attacked by a very large number of sperms? And as they drove at it, the obum began to spin, just like a Catherine wheel. That's very good. Now, what was the purpose of the spin? From the mechanistic point of view, the inequality of the spermal stimuli on it caused it to rotate because they were unequal attacks. From a metaphysical point of view, the spinning created a greater difficulty for the sperm to get in, so that only a very persistent, very dedicated sperm would get into that ovum. There is your skin surface and your physicality as such, the peripheral line, the brown one. The green one here represents your ideational structure, and the red one in the middle is your volitional essential self. Your essential self ideates by act of will. It creates ideas. This is very important from a therapeutic point of view, because supposing somebody comes and hits you with a hammer and you get a local bruise, that is a destructive, violent activity from outside your system. That's okay, because the moment you get hit, a message comes from the initiative center inside, just sort that lot out, will you please, and restore help. The curative intention in any situation comes from inside the being. The destructive activities that come from external stimuli can only attack your body, but they cannot actually make your center ill. That's very important therapeutically. The center of a being cannot be made ill by an external attack. It doesn't matter what it is, you put a man underneath a steamroller and flatten him. Unless he himself says, oh, diddums, poor me, he'll start repairing. He has the power to do so. He may have a reason for not doing so, in case anybody asks him to do it again to prove that he did it the first time. That's one of the faults of living in the 20th century. They always want you to do it again. Now let's think about this. If we call this the masculine initiative ideational being, then the external being here must be called feminine. It must be that which has been taken out from the center of being. And in the middle here, we have an area, a mid-zone, through which messages of initiative come from the center to the periphery, and from which, from the periphery to the center, pass the external stimuli. So the mid-zone must be hermaphroditic. It must be able to take a message from outside, from the physical body, from the feminine side, and pass it through the mid-zone of ideational into the volitional. So in that mid-zone here, we have around there ideation conditioned by substantial experience, which we feel and emote about. But inside this ring, we have ideation precipitated by volitional intention. Look how complicated that is. We've drawn three simple circles, and already it's very complex. The middle one is initiative, precipitating its next circle, ideation, pushing that as far as it can till it meets opposition, physical body. Your physical body, your ideational body, your volitional body. In Indian philosophy, your volitional body is called the causal body, and the ideational body is a subtle body, and your physical body is a gross body. But however we name it, in whatever system, we're up against a trinity. Let us keep that diagram in mind and think very carefully about it. We are all demoted, sent down from a primordial state of incandescence, preceded by an invisible, unknown, absolutely unimpeded, infinite self-will which cannot be defeated because there is only itself. Whatever it wills comes to be because it wills it. There is no opposition unless it wills an opposition for itself. And the first thing it wills for itself is an idea. And the idea is called the Logos in the fourth gospel. It is called by good intelligent mystics like Jacob Burma the anti-stroke to God the Father, because the volition itself is immediate, so that whatever it brings to be by an immediate act of volition will immediately vanish unless it immediately posits it again. So whatever it would do, as soon as created, would cease to be and would have to be reposited again. In Kabbalah, that is called the reign of the Edomite kings. They make universes and they vanish. I'm sure I made a universe a moment ago. Where's it gone? Never mind, make another. And then one brilliant specimen in that period said, I've got the secret. Make a form, make ideas, make ideation, make an eidetic structure. Will it, and set up a mechanism to keep it going so that it is self-perpetuating. And that world is the world of Plato's ideas, a world in which forms are willed to be self-perpetuating so that you don't actually need to keep repositing them by special attention. It's like learning to drive the car. At first you have to pay attention, which foot you put on which pedal, and this is the steering wheel and so on. And you condition your physical body to behave in a routine manner so that you can gradually learn to sit back and enjoy the scenery while you're going down. The motorway at 120 and the speed limit is 70, with your eye on the mirrors for the cops. Now we can only do all these marvellous things because we have liberated ourselves by making mechanisms. We can't liberate ourselves without mechanism. We can't come up out of the mines and out of the sewers unless we mechanize them and computerize them. The whole advance of Keynesian science is simply to release us for further creative activities. Now we are hermaphrodites, whether we like it or not. It's only a slight stress accent, a matter of a little bit of testosterone, a little bit of this or that hormone, and you can develop a lovely bust if you wanted one. Or you can get rid of it by a simple change of chemistry. Why so? Because chemistry is precipitated volition. Every chemical is a will to formulate in a certain way. And that's why drugs can work. That's why drugs can hallucinate you. Because they're actually mysterious powers. We are all hermaphrodites. But we are generally not aware of that. Now, what is the divine hermaphrodite? The divine hermaphrodite is the one that divines it, DV. That is to say, he is aware, reflectively, that he has as much woman in his manhood as he has manhood in his womanhood. If he's aware of this and can actually control these dual functions in himself, then he is a divine hermaphrodite and he is like God. The whole object of evolution, funnily enough, is to be just like God. That's not greedy, that's common sense. If God precipitates a world to pluralize gods, to make gods able to play with gods, then it is the duty of every reflexive being to become as godlike as possible. But to become godlike is to rediscover one's fundamental prepolar being as will, pure will, which wills to section itself as male, female, positive, negative, giver, receiver. And it wills this because it is the only way that it can make itself conscious of what it actually is. Without setting up a resistance, you can't test your own strength, your own intelligence. When you get hold of yourself, one hand by another, and press against yourself, you feel more like you, don't you? Do a simple exercise. Just press against the side of your head and press back with your head against your hand. And don't you become aware that you've got neck muscles? Have you become aware you've got neck muscles? If you're not, you're being lazy. Were you aware that you had neck muscles before you did that? Or had they lapsed? they had latched. You have all kind of things hidden in your underwear and elsewhere. You've got deltoids and funny things, biceps and triceps, and all funny things, the latissimus dorsi and so on. Marvelous mechanisms inside. You never think about them. Do you ever think what a rotten thing it is to create a marvelous mechanism and then forget you've got it? Like having a supercar which you've worked all your life to afford to buy, and you get it and you're so proud of it, you put it in the garage, you're frightened of using it in case some idiot parks his car and scratches it. So you don't use it. You just think about it. And the garage burns down, right? That would be a message from above if you did that. Here we are. We are, whether we like it or not, hermaphrodites. We become divine hermaphrodites only in one way, by self-conscious, reflexive awareness of the polarity of our own being. And in so doing, we have to make a decision. We cannot do it without making a decision. I mean, we all agree, don't we, that we're protoplasm. You agree, Trevor? Do you agree that you've got as much girl in you as you've got boy? Sure. Do you like it?
No.
You don't? Well, you better learn to like it, because otherwise you won't become it. You're doing your best. Now, the only reason a man doesn't like being a girl is because he's not yet a man. There's no other reason. Do you know that? Terrible thought, man. Most men are only halfway out of the pond. And the pond is woman. When you ponder on a thing, you're being a woman. When you deliberately analyze it logically, then you're being a man. And if you take the conclusions of your logic to their conclusion, you must affirm that the alpha, the beginning, and the omega, the end, are equally valid, because they are the same. There is no omega, a final conclusion of evolution, without an alpha, a beginning, a spirit that had this hidden in it and then precipitated it. If you once accept the conclusion, then all the men who are worried about the relative size of their genital organs or whether they'll function or not, if they stop worrying and say, I am a man, a woman, man, and I will assert this to be a logical fact. And having asserted it, I will say there is no difference whatever in ultimate value between being a little boy and a little girl. Now, can we affirm that? Absolutely. If so, we are divine hermaphrodites already. All we need is a bit of practice to prove it. Now, the enemy is inertia. What is inertia? It is the previously established way in which a being has been working. Nothing else. There is no mysterious power in the universe called inertia that comes and gets hold of you. No. There is only the way you have used yourself to date. That's all the inertia there is. So to overthrow inertia, what do you have to do? Reconceive yourself. Give birth to yourself in a new idea, a new substance, a new feeling sensation, a new initiative. But the old inertia said, oh, I've left it a bit late, why bother? Better to die quietly, and then next time round. Because, you see, the soul knows that it's immortal, so it doesn't care if it does die when it's made a mess of something, or when it's lost face. It will die and say, well, next time I'll do better. And this is codology, because the same thing will happen again. Because every time you do something, you have added a unit of inertia into your being. So if you actually said, I made a mess of my life, I might as well die, I'll fade away, everybody will be sorry, and then the next time I meet them, they'll treat me better. That would be a first step. Journey 1,000 miles begins with first step. to a new inertia, the inertia of saying every time you get born, I think I'll leave it till I've grown up, and then I'll go negative and die and try again. You actually establish a cycle of failure with self-imagery as the determinant. And think what that means. The center of our being is pure volition. Pure volition is initiative. It can do anything whatever. It has no inertia. It can do anything whatever. And if it thinks about it, it isn't being pure initiative. But what it can do is posit a thing to remind itself that it is really initiative. And the thing that it posits to remind itself that it is really initiative is the logos. Logos, remember logos, lambda, gamma. Lambda is that light, that incandescence, that intelligence, your energetic structure. Gamma is your physical body. When you look at the logos word, tell yourself, this logos says, my intelligence, my lambda, my energetic structure, which I willed, is the very, very coherence principle of the mineral matter of my body, which is gamma. There is no gamma structure other than lambda insight. And that insight is willed. And what happens then? We take our volition, pure volition, and we will with it reflexively, saying that whatever happens to me, I willed to put myself in that situation. Now what happens? Well, I was aware I had to attend an exorcism of evil spirits. And the woman who was possessed by the evil spirits, having had explained to her that there weren't any evil spirits other than life force frustrated, and having had it demonstrated to her that there weren't, because the evil spirits that were frightening her went away when she looked at them and wouldn't come back, she then accused the gentleman who'd been exercising the evil spirits of making her believe in evil spirits when they don't exist. And she told him off. And he said to me, this is terrible, she's accusing me of misleading her and so on. She's very, very annoyed with me. And I said, no, she isn't annoyed with you at all. You must tell her that she's not annoyed with you. She's annoyed with herself for trusting you. Now that's a key thought. Nobody is ever really annoyed with somebody else. They're annoyed with themselves for trusting the other person. And they can't bear the feeling of annoyance inside themselves because they know it's true. So what do? That psychological trick. They project the annoyance outwards onto the nearest unfortunate target and say, I'm annoyed with you. Why? Because I can't bear being annoyed with me. I'm a nice fellow. How can I be annoyed with me? I'm intelligent. I've got initiative. I've got ideas. I've got sensitive feelings. I've got real substantiality. So there can't be anything wrong with me, but there's something wrong somewhere, so it must be with you. And that's called projection. Now, it's a very good thing, projection, because it allows you, like every bad thing, it's got a good thing in it, it allows you to see outside yourself in somebody else objectified that which you dare not look at inside yourself. Because inside yourself, from your red center, from your pure volition, you know perfectly well that your intention originally was nothing but the highest. You never had any intention of doing anything but good, did you? Do everything. You're going to make an orderly universe. You won't notice, you'll be modest about it, you won't tell everybody you're the boss, you'll just do good everywhere. Your intention is pure and perfect. How then can you be at fault? Answer, you can't. It can only be that a wicked stimulus from outside has come in and invaded you and distorted your original plan. Sounds okay. Except that the stimulus that came in came from another being with the same good intention. And that's where you have to compromise with other people. Because if you don't, you will continuously project your own error of leaning on somebody on the outside instead of leaning on your own volitional center. When you realize that you are, and like Trevor, who's reformed in the last few minutes and has decided that women are every bit as good as men, haven't you, Trevor? He's being modest now. He doesn't want to shout yes and yell that. He's just quietly inside admitting it and saying, well, it's a bit rough. It's like being a doctor and spending God knows how many years at a university studying things that are quite out of date from a 30-year-old textbook. You don't want to admit it, do you? Trevor? His eyebrows wiggle and he pursed his lips. Or his lips pursed and his eyebrows wiggle. What is... Pardon? Yes, on my part. Yes. Would you like to explain it to me? Yeah. You can feel the truth. Well, if you felt the truth, why was the analysis incorrect? Had it not got to be acceptable to you?
Yes.
But hadn't it got to be acceptable to you in the level at which you conceptualize yourself?
It's a limbo.
You've gone back into the primordial darkness now. Haven't you?
I had it right.
What?
I can see what you are. I can see what you are.
But I'm trying to twist you into.
No, well, partly, yes. And that's where the opposition is.
Well, do you know there's no education of beings with their bottoms in the pond except by trickery? Do you know that?
No education.
No education whatever of beings with bottoms in ponds except by trickery. Because they're frightened of their bottoms drying up if they bring them in the air. So you have to pull their legs a bit to get them out. And that's why Jesus always spoke parables to people and then a double parable to the disciples. Because he said to the disciples, and to those that are without, I speak only in parables, but to you it is given to understand the kingdom of heaven. That's so they could nod their heads. And before they knew what was happening, they were teachers, weren't they? What?
Getting their bloody heads chopped off.
Just having their heads chopped off. Right. Can we try again, Trevor? Have you now passed to the state where you can see, and you're not going to be pushed into admitting it by me doing tricks, are you?
No.
Can you... Yeah.
And defining what you're saying is an external stimulus, you say, I've got to lean. I'm not willing to do that.
Oh.
I'm not willing to do it.
No, you're not willing to do it.
Except for inertia.
For inertia?
Yes, which is a will that's causing me to have made the statement I have.
Oh.
About the thing like the initiative, do I like?
Yeah.
Well, and I said, not much, I'm being true.
Within your then limitations.
Right.
Well, that's several seconds ago, isn't it? Well, you must feel that now. Within your present, newly enlightened condition, are you prepared to confess that women are just as valuable in the ultimate scheme of things as men? You are. Yes. And you really feel that's true, don't you? And when you look back at your earlier condition, when you didn't want to believe that, at that time, was it because you didn't believe it or because you didn't want to believe it?
It was too painful.
Too painful. You didn't want to believe it. But you actually knew it was true even then, didn't you? But it was too painful to accept. Now, this is the whole thing about getting out of the pond. Remember, we have been demoted from a condition of invisible volition through visible ideational structures called minds. And from there to solar plexus self-willed, and then to planetary physical bodies. We've come down. And we have to climb back again in our awareness internally. So we must reverse the order of descent, mustn't we? The meaning of the physical incarnation of God in Christ is simply that every intelligence, to complete its own education, must come down, must be demoted, and must initially agree with the demotion. In the dark, before the incandescence of the universe, we are all actual monads, that we are eternal spirits, fire spirits, seraphs, with God hidden. And if we didn't agree with him sending us down, we could, because we are of an identical substance with God, refuse to go. So that we are down here means that we have acquiesced in the demotion, in the going down.
I can't see any truth about that in evidence. Now, except for one aspect of it,
yes,
and that is the logic of the darkness.
The logic of the darkness.
Yes.
But you can feel that, can't you?
Yes. Of necessity, it must be so, because the darkness must be sensing for us to be aware of its darkness, life potential.
Right.
That's
yes.
And
you originate in that darkness, don't you? Yes. And the darkness is not made of parts, is it? It's a continuum. And therefore, the particular which has come to be you, in that state of primordial darkness, must be acquiescing in the descent into matter. Because she's not other than the continuum. The continuum can't send itself down against its own will, but only with its own will. So you must have acquiesced. Yes. That's the meaning of the Christian statement, that salvation is impossible without crucifixion, death, burial and resurrection. They're symbolic ways of expressing that psychological, spiritual truth. The infinite power, utterly and absolutely, infinitely self-determinant, cannot pluralize itself, cannot make beings to play with without cutting itself actually into bits. That is, by act. But that doesn't affect it being a continuum, because an action is only a modality of the continuum. So the original decision that you made then, in the dark, when you got in the light and were caught by phenomena and came down progressively into the human body on Earth, that's the original decision you deliberately forgot. Because if you didn't forget it, you would not be able to concentrate fully on the examination of the trials and tribulations of your life in the physical body, could you? So mythologically you are said to drink the waters of Lethe, of forgetfulness, before you incarnate again. You are an eternal spirit incarnate in the visible body. You can be kicked and hacked and pinched by the people around about you, can't you?
Yes.
And the lower self doesn't like that fact. But it's your higher self that said you cannot complete your education unless you actually do go down and experience being kicked, being beaten, being thrashed, being crowned with thorns and so on. You can't be complete. You must know all things, must you not? Ultimately, to be yourself. Otherwise, there's going to be a deficiency in you somewhere, isn't there? And you're going to say, oh, there's something I don't know about, which that fellow knows about, so I must know about it. But the only way we can know all things is by suffering all things. There's no other way. That says so logically. Now, the next thing is, we've said it in the realm of logic. Can we say it in the realm of the will? We've gone from the physical fact of being pinched and kicked to the idea of being pinched and kicked. And now how about the will to be kicked and pinched? Is it?
Yes.
There's a lady sitting next to you. Give her one of your fingers and tell it to give it a good bite. And give it a good bite. What's the matter with her? Bite to hurt. Does it taste horrible? Yeah. But what is the difference? What is the difference to you handing your finger to her to bite, and her suddenly, without your permission, biting your finger?
Prior assent.
Prior assent. Nothing else. But what happens to the quality of the sensation if you've got prior assent?
It's a lot easier to bear.
Now, isn't that the whole key to life? Instead of waiting for them to kick you, say, anybody feel like kicking anybody today? Here I am. The whole quality changes, doesn't it? It does. No, that's not kidality, that's real. Sound psychology, isn't it? Real empirical psychology. That the moment you change your will and seize the initiative in that anticipatory act of self-sacrifice, you've totally immobilized the opposition. Now, isn't that nice? Isn't it simple?
Yes.
Isn't it simple? No, they might not. The question is whether, if they agree with it logically, do you agree with it logically as a proposition? Some say, huh? And some say, Paul and Keynes. If you see the logic of it, then you're in that middle zone there, the intellective zone. To make it absolutely dynamic and super powerful, to collect what is called by the mystics dragon power, you convert it to volition. You say, I'm actually willing to endure all things. So that, like St. Paul, you can say, I don't boast. Not that kind of fellow, I don't boast. If I did boast, I'd have more to boast about than you've got.
There's a difference between putting your finger in a person's mouth and asking them to get hold of a pair of nutcrackers and squash your balls, isn't it?
Not really. Have you tried both? No, there isn't really, because as a matter of fact, if you actually offer those delectable morsels to a girl. Do you know she has a deep biological respect for them? And she say, oh, don't be silly.
I'm not talking about her, I'm talking about some other fella.
Oh, a fella? Why are you getting yourself mixed up with fellas suddenly? Fellas won't jump on them either. So, not if you've got that much nerve, they say. Well, we only jump on them to terrify him, and the blight has stolen a march on us. Do you believe it?
No.
Well, I shall ask Dr. Wadsworth, you lie down there again, huh? And I'll ask him if he's got the...
this isn't a different sort of situation. You haven't got somebody raging mad at you that's threatening to squash your bloody balls.
Yeah, but how do they get raging mad at you other than you being stupidly cocky?
People get bashed up. Crowds come out from football matches because their team has lost, and they just set on anybody without any provocation.
But haven't they gone there in order to be justified in setting on anybody without provocation?
I'm talking about the blokes on the receiving end.
Oh, they went there for the same reason.
No, I'm talking about a passerby. It's not
what's he doing passing by a football ground anyway? Very intelligent people see if there's a football match on, they don't go that way in their cars, do they? Oh. I'm suggesting, I put it to you, Gerhardt, that you yourself wouldn't put yourself in the kind of position where that would be likely to happen.
No, I'd be bloody terrified.
You're not truly scientific. To be scientific, you must be totally disinterested. An entirely objective and a sharp observer, with one-eyed coincidence judgment. You measure it. And if you did that, you'd find lots of volunteers. Wouldn't you? Yes, but if you did it correctly with the scientific thing, you could make at least 100,000 quid in the Daily Mirror immediately. You'd manage without them. See this basic nervousness in men? Because they're putting the accent in the wrong place. You see, the particular commodities that Gerhardt is talking about are extrusions of will.
That's a lovely thought, that is, from some sort.
They're just wills dangling about, waiting to be noticed. Did it ever occur to you why a man has those things which are supposed to be essential to existence pendant upon his body, dangling where in a natural situation they could be seen and admired?
So he can be tested.
Tested, yes. Yes. Look at the etymology of that when you get home. It's all a question of daring to walk out, isn't it? And show what you've got and see what happens. The whole thing in the universe is this, that the absolute intelligent power, if it had not created a plurality of beings, of which we are some, would be languishing on its own, just looking at its own darkness to itself. Now that wasn't good enough. Because when God said, "Let there be light," he said, "And it was good." He thought that light was good. He made it and he said it was good. That's a good definition. Anything I make is good. When he has posited that universe and pluralized in that way, what is his next thing to do with the phenomenal world, with the world of appearential beings? The next thing is to do, push them to every conceivable evolution, every possibility of formal demonstration of conflict, of everything else, until you have totally exhausted the possibilities of phenomenal existence. Try all things, hold fast the good, is the operative thought. Now, if you can actually affirm that as a jolly good idea, and I put it to you, it's quite easy to imagine, which would you rather be, wrapped in infinite darkness, in perfect self-possession of no thing but infinite darkness, knowing yourself to be fully omnipotent, omniscient, in the dark, and no universe, would you rather stay in that condition, or would you like to phenomenalize yourself, pluralize yourself, temporalize your eternity, materialize your spirit, and see what else you can do apart from languishing in the dark, which you do? You have come into the phenomenal world. At some point you made the decision to do so, otherwise you wouldn't be here. Now, are you regretting your decision?
Obviously I must be.
It would appear so. But if you examine yourself, you will reverse that decision. You say, I forgot that I sent myself down.
Yeah, but you have to be convinced of that. Then you can make the next step, and until you're convinced about it...
Who is going to convince you?
Internally,
in the will. Yeah, in the will. So it's entirely a matter of will, whether you will or will not convince yourself that it is a matter of will.
Why not a feeling?
Well, a feeling is an assessment, isn't it? Yeah. How do you assess? How do you assess whether you have willed or not?
By feeling that you've
done so.
Working energy that manifests in results.
In results, that's right. That's the outer circle, the external result. And in between there's an ideational process governing the structure of the manifestation.
But where does consciousness come into?
Consciousness, remember the word consciousness, means you have analysed the content. Before consciousness, there is absolute sentience, not yet cut up, not yet analysed. The SCI in conscious means snip, 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 cut into bits like scissors. Before you cut it into bits, which is an intellectual act, not a substantial act. It's an intellectual act. Before you make that act, you are not conceals. You are absolutely sentient. You are a pre-pluralized being essence. But you're not conscious.
Well, if consciousness would never be defined, it was necessarily really an eternal new.
Okay, that's fine. It's a nice analysis. You won't find better in there.
How then, if sentience prior to consciousness,
yes.
Where is the transition in the analogy we use tonight?
Which one?
Of the idea of being from darkness to light to mineral.
Well, it's quite simple, really. Our sensation of light is produced by evolving a pair of optics. Yes, but the light of consciousness, is it not true that a congenitally blind person doesn't have a sensation of light in the mind, so he doesn't talk about the light of consciousness because that's a metaphor. He might talk about the sound of consciousness if he's not deaf. Or the taste of it, or the smell of it. Yeah? Because when you talk about consciousness, you're talking about the content. But there isn't any content other than that which is willed. You will yourself your own content. Yeah? So the little circle in the middle, the red one, wills that green one, which is the ideational structure, and then it wills to operate the ideational one in the material world as an expression, a pressing out. But it's all a product of the will. And the will is the male and the external is the female. And between the two is the hermaphroditic process, where you admit that you've got an idea and you admit that you've got a feeling of being. Your feeling of beingness is feminine, your idea is masculine. You admit that you can initiate changes, that's masculine. You admit that you suffer the action of changes of other beings, that's feminine. And those four processes go on inside everyone. But they don't become conscious until you appoint for them a word to separate them from another content. So it's through the word that you make your analysis. Hence logos, ratio, word, and logic, the process of clarification of mental contents through the word. The only enemy is inertia. There is no inertia other than previously established patterns of will. So what does it mean to us? We have to go back on the center of will. Now the tendency in your mind is to look for external stimuli for anything you do. But that's only a product of a few million years inertia. Once the penny drops, once you comprehend that really volition has put us where we are, that volition has to be rediscovered. You go inside yourselves, you go through your receptive feeling passivity to the external stimulus, your feminine nature, and you dive inside yourself to your will. And at that point, a very peculiar thing occurs. It inverts the symbology. You have now become very feminine, because if you define the feminine, you define the feminine as non-rational, don't you?
Yes, that's
the heat of that. Yes. But that initiative is the same thing as non-rational, isn't it? So that the very thing that we started by saying, masculine initiative is feminine will. Isn't it? We've turned the thing upside down. Can you see that that's justified? it is a fact that in a masculine dominated society, technology, know-how, mathematics, geometry, logic, ideas have stated and been stated to be masculine in origin, and feeling and poetry and music and things have been said to be feminine. But if we examine them, we find that they're all hermaphroditic. You can't have a Mozart without feeling, and you can't have a Mozart symphony without good notation. The masculine and the feminine are actually inextricably not true at all. It is only a stress accent to verbal usage in the social structure, and by social I'm not meaning merely on earth, but in the social structure of the macrocosmos, that this apportioning of initiative and ideation to the male and a feeling and substantiality to the female has been brought into effect. Only by that polarization can we get the necessary tensions to make ourselves aware of our own being. And once we've understood that, we begin to be very, very pleased at the opposition we get. Because all oppositions are there, willed by that dark absolute, and agreed with by us as individual monads at our top level, our hexalic level. We agree with it. We cannot complete our evolution. We cannot attain our true selfhood, our real, utter determination of the soul freely without this opposition. And therefore we have to say we have willed, like the dark will the light, we have willed to impose on ourselves every conceivable kind of opposition that we experience and encounter. When we accept the theory of that, the theory is on that middle circle, then we have only one thing to do. Make it volitional. Instead of merely nodding the head at the idea, will it. Instead of running away from opposition, seek it. As soon as the word gets round that you're looking for opposition, they won't give it to you. They only give it to you if you don't want it. If they think you can assimilate it and deal with it, they won't give it to you because it's feeding you. It's making you more powerful than they are. And that they will not voluntarily do until they get to a very, very high level where they don't care two hoots about power of any kind because they've got it. Now how do you all feel that if you accept first the proposition? Have you got physical bodies, please? All of you, there's any lurkers about that haven't. Yeah, right. Have you got ideational behaviour? I mean, do you think? Have you got ideas of any kind whatever? Yeah. And have you got will? Right. Now tell me which is prior, your physical body, your ideas, or your will? The will, right? Now if you remember that, isn't it your duty to yourselves every moment to go back on your center and say, I am willing this situation. I refused to react mechanically to an external stimulus. I will my behavior as from now. And I will not project on another person the responsibility for that willing. Can you do it? Can you feel it? Okay, isn't it? Is there anything left in the whole universe worth learning? No. It's the very ground of all ethical systems. So let's go back to it and try, say within the next half hour, just try to get hold of, and try means threefold, get hold of your body, get hold of your idea, feel it, and then will it. Whatever you're doing, say, I'm willing to say this. Not I'm being trapped into saying it. I'm willing to say it. When you're drinking your coffee, will it. Don't do it mechanically. If you bite a bun, will the bite. Don't do it mechanically. if everything you do is done in that way, it is a perfect act. Can't be otherwise. And when you do such an act reflexively, you are, at that very moment, a divine hermaphrodite. And if the next moment you forget it, you're not the divine hermaphrodite. So you have to continuously reposit yourself in that process.